Welcome to the Isaka Podcast. On today's offstage and off-script edition of the podcast, we're visiting with author and journalist Jamie Bartlett, who will be the closing keynote speaker at the InfoSecurity Isaka North America Expo and Conference, which will take place November 20th and 21st in New York City. Jamie, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
One of your books, The People vs. Tech, contends that the internet is killing democracy. What do you mean by that, and what should be done about it?
I suppose, like most books, you have to have a slightly catchy title that doesn't always exactly reflect the contents, because if I were to choose the title myself, it would be How the Internet as Currently Constituted is Undermining Modern Liberal Representative Democracies. That wouldn't be quite as catchy on the bookshelves, would it? So we keep it nice and simple. But that's the argument, essentially, that we have a very particular system of democratic government across most of the developed Western world, and it's a representative liberal democracy with a relatively large middle class, a strong press, informed citizens, all these sort of rules and regulations and norms and cultures that we've created over several decades that, to a greater or lesser extent, ensure that our democracies work reasonably well. Not perfect by any means, but that's how it is. And suddenly you have a digital technology and it doesn't quite follow the same rules. It doesn't have the same logic. Our education system hasn't been designed for information overload rather than hasn't been designed for the kind of flows of information that we have to deal with on a daily basis. Our election law hasn't been designed to deal with possible overseas involvement. And so what I'm seeing, when you look at the news today, you see lots of apparently quite unrelated stories to do with whether it's untraceable cryptocurrencies or Russian interference in elections or bullying or a shrinking middle class. They're often seen in isolation, but I prefer to see them as all part of the same story, which is a system of government that is not fit for purpose for how our primary means of communication now works. So how do we deal with that? What do we do about that? I mean, I'm not blaming the big technology companies, because I think it's a sort of more systemic problem. I mean, the simple one, of course, is we've got to upgrade, we've got to change the democratic institutions that we have. That's another big question entirely, and we can go into some of the details on that, but that's essentially what I see the answers going to be.
In terms of modernizing some of our institutions, is there anything that you would consider to be a logical starting point?
There is, actually. Amazingly, I think the story that's galvanized people on this subject more than any over the last few months has been the one about Cambridge Analytica and the Donald Trump election, which is something, by the way, that I covered in great detail for the BBC in 2017 in a one-hour special about it, which has never been seen in the US, even though I went inside Donald Trump's campaign headquarters called Project Alamo down in San Antonio, Texas, and it involved interviewing a lot of the senior people involved with Cambridge Analytica. Unfortunately, no one in America has seen this program. I suppose it's politicized data and made people understand that there's a lot of ways in which election laws aren't really fit for purpose. And it's extremely frustrating in some senses, because I think the role of Cambridge Analytica in terms of changing people's minds through micro-targeted adverts is overstated. I don't think there's all that much evidence that actually Cambridge Analytica could change millions of people's minds. I just think they were doing for Trump a slightly better job than their equivalents for Hillary Clinton. All political parties are using micro-targeted adverts through Facebook and other platforms now. It's completely industry standard. And I think that's a far more important part of the story, that this is actually a long-running change that's transforming how we understand elections. Now, no developed country has actually updated their electoral law to reflect this. We don't really, for example, in the UK, and I think it's the same in the US, in Canada, in most of the developed world, there aren't really any rules which tell political parties exactly what they need to do to declare the adverts that they run on social media during a campaign. And this, to me, is fairly simple. You need to update the law so that every single political advert that's ever shown to anybody is published elsewhere on a transparent database that other people, especially journalists, can check, and that the regulators can check, so we can have a bit more confidence that the regulators can check that what people are seeing is accurate, or at least roughly accurate, or at least in line with our expectations about how elections should be run. And this is really important, because what I think people don't understand is whatever Cambridge Analytica was doing in 2016, profiling people based on 5,000 data points and so on, I want you to imagine what a similar company might be doing in 2035 or 2040 or 2045, and how much more advanced that will be, how much more targeted that will be, how much more data that will actually involve. And it's pretty obvious that we need to change this fairly quickly before it's too late. And I don't see this as a particularly difficult challenge to overcome, and yet no one seems to be able to do it.
The dark net is another of your major areas of interest. How concerned should the public be about what transpires on the dark net?
I think the dark net is one of those parts of the internet that, while relatively small, has a disproportionately large impact. So the dark net is actually, some people report this completely wrong and say it's much bigger than the normal internet, but that's wildly inaccurate. It's tiny by comparison. It has only a few thousand sites. But it's important because it's serving as a sort of warehouse, a clearinghouse for criminality, where you can buy an awful lot of stolen personal information, social security numbers, stolen password and username combinations. You can buy all sorts of illegal drugs and access to other illegal materials. So even though it's small, it has a large impact, because what it means is there's a constantly running trade in a lot of people's personal information. And this is driving a sort of, I suppose the best way of describing it is it's democratizing the access to easy to do forms of criminality. So it lowers the barriers to entry into simple forms of various types of criminality. And so you could be talking about, you know, a 14 or 15 year old is now able to commit credit card fraud because it's very, very easy indeed to buy stolen credit card numbers on the dark net. And a lot of teenagers will know how to do it. Similarly, they might be able to get hold of very powerful drugs that would not have been available to them before because it would have been restricted by geography. And I think part of the very sad increase in opioid use in some parts of the US and elsewhere is because it's incredibly easy to get those drugs now. And I'm afraid that's also true of illegal images of children. And so it's not that it's the only problem on the internet by any means, but what it does do is it provides a sort of easy watering hole for people that want to get involved in various types of crime. And because it's so difficult to shut down, it has this disproportionately large effect.
Has the dark net been evolving at a rapid rate, or have many of the challenges that you've described been pretty steady in the past few years?
It has been changing. One thing I've definitely noticed, that I was probably myself a bit too dismissive of the ways in which law enforcement would evolve and try to get on top of this threat, because I remember saying 4 or 5 years ago, the law cannot keep on top of this. It's impossible. It's too distributed. You can never shut it down. It's a hopeless, impossible task for law enforcement. But to their credit, they have all around the world, in the Netherlands, in particular, in France, in the UK, in Italy, all over the place, the authorities have actually gotten far better at trying to monitor the different sites, using an awful lot of disruption techniques. So typically they will go on and try and mess around with the markets, making fake listings. Because remember, these places are a bit like Amazon or eBay. So if you can make fake accounts, fake listings, people don't receive their products, confidence in these markets declines. And so there's this sort of cat and mouse game where law enforcement's getting better, but every time they do something, the markets evolve slightly and change. So an awful lot of evolution in these criminal marketplaces to do with new payment systems, integrating new cryptocurrencies, building in multi-signature escrow wallets so there's a bit more security, moving from, as I think is happening pretty much as we speak, from these large open marketplaces that everybody can see to smaller single vendor websites, which is probably a little harder to disrupt. So it's always changing and it's always evolving. But I think the general underlying trend of always getting easier to use, always getting simpler, more accessibility, that has been fairly consistent over the last 5 years.
Tell us about your background with the Demos think tank, and especially how AI and machine learning have been useful in some of the team's efforts.
Yeah, so about a decade or so ago, me and some colleagues had noticed that there was an awful lot of commercial applications and commercial software for using machine learning to crunch large data sets, mostly for marketing and advertising purposes. So to generate profiles on people for better targeting or to do better social media analytics, to see conversations about products and that kind of stuff. We were, as social scientists, were a little bit envious because we thought, well, there's all this amazing data now. There's all these social media sites. This is, remember, this is sort of 2010. There's all these amazing new social media platforms and they're generating this amazing volume of data about all the different aspects of human life. And we can't get it. We don't know how to process that amount. We're used to statistical surveys or face-to-face interviews or workshops and focus groups. So we teamed up with the university department, the machine learning department here in the UK, and just basically tried to develop some software, but as importantly, some methodology about how you could apply machine learning to social science research and to sort of more, I suppose, government-focused type of research. So how can we understand new political movements based on how they tweet? How can we understand attitudes towards the police based on trends in Facebook posts? And we basically since then just started trying to develop this sort of hybrid model, sort of social media science, we called it, whereby we could use techniques of machine learning to understand social phenomena better, but not for marketing or advertising, but for social science. And back then, we're fairly unusual. It wasn't really done much, but I think now the field has moved on an awful lot. You have all these digital anthropology classes. You know, social media science itself is becoming a large discipline. Academics are all extremely interested in the datification of their various disciplines. And so I think it's become a far richer, far more interesting field of work than it was when we started. But the actual reason I first got interested is because I always noticed that fringe group and extremist groups, radical political movements in particular, were always very, very good at using technology. They were always early adopters of the very latest platforms that were out there that would allow them to reach new people. And I just wanted to understand them better, because I thought the rest of us could learn something from them.
One of the areas you touched on in your recent blog post for the Isaka Now blog was some of your observations on the current social media landscape. Given the occasionally toxic and polarizing nature of social media today, do you consider the parts that are problematic to outweigh the upside of social media?
It's very hard to answer that question exactly, because I think it really depends on what country you're living in. If you're talking, for example, about encryption, if you're in a country where you don't trust your government at all, very limited press freedom, having powerful, easy-to-use encryption software and new forms of communication is potentially amazing for you. But then again, if you're working for the FBI or the UK police or wherever, and you're trying to shut down some criminal organization, they're a real nuisance. And so every time I answer that question, it really always depends on exactly what specific case you might be referring to. I mean, to me personally, I think that when it comes to the quality of political debate, I see it as a quite direct reflection of the logic and incentives of the platforms we now use. And if most of our political debate is now taking place, or at least a large proportion of it is taking place, on platforms which are essentially advertising companies that trade on your attention and keeping you on there for as long as possible and encouraging you to share emotional, sticky content because that's what works well in advertising, then our political debate has become a reflection of that. Equally emotional, equally sort of rapid, trading on attention and outrage and frustration and anger, because this is the logic of those platforms. And I don't think that was ever the intention of any of the big tech firms at all. I just think it's a consequence of how their business model has evolved. So when you talk about the nature and style of politics today, which I think in most countries, most people would agree, has become, at least in the last 15 years or so, more divisive and more emotive, it is a result of how our technology systems are set up. And in the end, that's a bit of a problem for democracy, because democracies aren't really designed to deal with that level of, or at least not to deal with a huge increase in emotion and division. I mean, maybe you'll think I'm a bit of a techno-determinist because I think that the way we behave is determined by technology, but I think I am, and I think it's true. So I think we need to figure out how we can reshape slightly the incentive systems of our platforms. And I think that will have an effect on the quality of our political debate.
So as we near the 2020s, which cybersecurity themes do you expect to become especially impactful in the new decade?
Well, the two in the 2020s that I think are most obvious is criminals, are, like I said before, or outsiders, are early adopters of all technology. And we are all, of course, slightly obsessed in the technology sector at the moment about automation, automation of driving, automation of CV checking, automation of investment, HR, all these other things. But of course, crime is also going to become highly automated. And there's no reason that criminals aren't thinking the same as us. They're sitting down thinking, well, how could I use machine learning or AI so I can do less work and make more money for myself? So I think one of the big trends is going to be a huge amount of investment from criminals into using machine learning to automatically identify weaknesses and flaws in certain types of software, to fire out automated and far more personalized types of spear phishing emails. I mean, if you imagine you took all the techniques of Cambridge Analytica for their very good targeted advertising, and you could automate that all up, and instead of getting somebody to vote one way or another, you're actually doing it to get them to click on a link so you can then infect their computer and then do whatever from that point. This is going to be, of course, the future of crime, more and more automation. And I think that will change slightly the risk register. I mean, how people understand their risk, because I think if everything is automated, to me, it means that any weakness will be far more readily identified and then exploited. And I think that does change slightly how businesses should understand risk. And of course, the other big trend, which criminals are rubbing their hands about with glee, is the current craze for connecting everything to the internet. Bruce Schneier has said that everything is essentially becoming a computer. So your fridge is becoming a computer, and so is your I'm just looking around my house, and so is your radio and your microwave and your television, and more of your physical objects are essentially becoming computers with applications running on them. And that means that the security of everything is essentially the security of computers. And we all know that computer systems haven't always been really designed with security in mind. So what that means is more things that are possibly vulnerable and more things in people's houses, in their daily lives, their coffee machines getting hacked into or their baby monitors getting hacked into. And this is, of course, going to be far more visceral for people when it's their physical objects rather than just their laptops or phones. And I think when you put those two things together, you are talking about far more devices and far more different types of devices and far more automation. It's hard to see how this is going to get better before it gets a little worse, I'm afraid.
Going back to that concept of automation of crime, which is probably a chilling prospect for a lot of people, are you optimistic law enforcement will be able to keep up?
Oh, well, I'm sure that, of course, the answer is going to be more automation of the defenses against this as well. If machines are going to be very, very good at scanning software and finding weaknesses and automatically running exploits against them, well, that's also what the defenders are going to have to be doing, automatically scanning for weaknesses and automatically running patches against them. Well, I'll tell you one thing. 5 years ago, when I was far more doom and gloom about this stuff, because I was really feeling quite down about it, and I thought we've got no chance of getting on top of this. But the cybersecurity sector, I mean, the market is incredibly good at quickly responding to demand. And I've been blown away by just how well the sector has responded to this. I mean, you know as well, the cybersecurity sector in the last 5 years is unrecognizable. The size and the scale and the investment, the sophistication of it. So I think there will be a response from the market and from governments. I'm sure about that. But there will be, unfortunately, people who will suffer in the meantime. I think one of the things for a consumer is going to be far more cyber insurance. So if you can't be entirely sure that you can keep yourself safe, at least you can keep yourself insured against certain risks. That's always been society's way of dealing with large systemic risk. And I think it will be the same again here.
Jamie, I really enjoyed the conversation, and we're looking forward to hearing more from you on some of these topics at the InfoSecurity ISACA North America Conference in New York in November. Thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, can't wait. Look forward to meeting you and everybody else over there.
That's our program for today. For more on the 2019 InfoSecurity ISACA North America Expo and Conference, visit www.isaca.org/conferences.